morning. This is Susan Gingrich, commonly known locally as the Herb Lady and other names. This evening, we are here to talk about herbs and different ways that we can use them. This is kind of a kickoff from the show that we did with Sherry Edwards on Sunday evening about medicinal use of things in the backyard. Now, one of the things that I would like to point your attention to is that we have been using herbs very successfully medicinally and as for food for as long as people have been on this planet. I remember going to an herb conference many years ago that Stephen Horn was speaking at, and he said something that really struck me at the time. He said, "The God I believe in didn't make the only right and true medicine available to a small handful of wealthy people on one continent at the end of the last century. He made good medicine available throughout time to everybody who was willing to look for it." And I love that quote. So tonight, this afternoon, what I'd kind of like to talk about is the historical use and the legal situation around herbs that's been going on. We have Ralph Fusitola, who's commonly known as the vitamin lawyer, with us this evening, too, and he's going to tell us some things as well. Now, let's go back 500 years into Europe. We find the Black Plague rolling around through the villages in France, and as you may know, there were the common scientific medicine at the time was to bloodlet for everything that happened. And that was based on the notion that you were sick because you had evil spirits in you and you had to have those drained out. And we think of that as a kind of a silly notion, but at the time that was considered high science compared to common herbal wisdom or everyday stuff that the older women in the culture knew about. In fact, this went on for so long that our first president, George Washington, actually died of bloodletting. He had they had removed something on the order of 5 pints of blood overnight because he had pneumonia, and that was done in the very late 1700s. So this was the best science we had at the time. And during the plague, they were going around bloodletting everyone, and we had a doctor who was kind of, he's probably better known now than he even was then, Dr. Nostradamus, who used a pill made with rose petals and cedar and clove oil, which would be a good painkiller, and there were no doubt some antiseptics and so forth in there. He was getting very good results with his remedy. There was also a wonderful story about four thieves who would go into people's homes after they had all died of the plague, and they would rob the place blind. They finally got caught and brought before a judge at the time, and the judge was more interested in how they managed to not get sick than he was about the fact that they were robbing everyone. So he finally cut them a deal that if they would tell, he would let them go. So they finally gave their remedy, which was that they would soak garlic, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme in vinegar for a couple of weeks, and then every time that they went out to do their thieving, they would wash their hands and forearms in this solution, and then daily they took 2 or 3 teaspoons full of it, and that kept them from getting the plague. So even then, there was this constant battle between the right way to do medicine as bloodletting or to use the common standard thing. But I thought that would be interesting as a lead-in to your meeting Mr. Ralph Fusitola. Ralph, are you there?
Hello, Susan.
Hi.
All right. That's a very interesting introduction and a very interesting story. Parsley, rosemary, sage, and thyme. Okay.
Yes. And, of course, we hear that in songs now.
Yeah,
and that brings up another point. The herbal remedies were so put down by the legal situation at the time that they really came to us through songs, little ditties, the little nursery rhyme, Ring Around the Rosie, A Pocket Full of Posies, Ashes, Ashes, We All Fall Dead. It was actually a song about the plague.
That's right. Now, the plague was in the 1300s.
Was it?
But by the 1500s, the time of King Henry VIII, things were going along in the same vein, and I think if we're talking today about the development of legal rights in the area of herbal use and self-help, a good place to start is the Herbalist Charter of Henry VIII, and I can tell you a little bit of the story of that.
Oh, I'd love that.
And It's really kind of interesting and how it applies to here in America. Well, you know, when the American colonies declared their independence as sovereign states, you know, back in 1776, they each adopted the laws of England as the common law of the state. And as other states were added to the Union, almost every one of them also adopted the common law of England as their common law. And part of the common law of England is, of course, the Herbalist Charter, which is an act of Henry VIII in the, I believe, the eighth year of his reign, actually. And, you know, it's astounding to note that many of the issues confronting alternative practitioners today are the same issues that the Act of Parliament addressed. So this was an Act of Parliament that was meant to protect the herbalists. And who were they protecting them from? Well, in the 16th century, as well as in the 21st century, right, licensed physicians and surgeons were going to court to ban the activities of the alternative practitioners of their day, the herbalists. Parliament
just
had
like now, then.
Yeah, Parliament had adopted a law saying no one could practice medicine in the city of London unless they were licensed by the College of Surgeons and Physicians, or whatever it was called. And so the College of Surgeons and Physicians immediately went into court to try to stop the herbalists. And so Parliament ordered an end to the misuse of the courts to enforce this new licensing law. And they ordered that the herbalists be protected from, and I'm quoting here, suit, vexation, trouble, penalty, or loss of their goods.
I love that.
You know, and in my opinion, this ancient Act of Parliament, which applied to England and to the king's other dominions, actually it says in the Act of Parliament it applies to the king's other dominions, which of course would be the American colonies. And thus it remains part of our common law today. Unless it's specifically repealed, the common law remains the common law. The legal principle is that legislators have to be explicit when they repeal part of the ancient common law, and it's never been repealed. So what does it say?
Herbalist, then I should be legal to practice herbs without the vexation of somebody coming in.
Right. But of course, as in all these things, you know, there are complexities within complexities, and it's really interesting. If anyone would like to do so, they can actually read the charter. And it's got some. And when you read it and you hear the history in it, and you realize, gosh, nothing's changed in half a millennium. But if you'd like to read it, I posted it on the internet. I did it partly in memory of one of the finest people of the last century, Dr. William H. Moore Jr., who was both a homeopathic MD and a lawyer, a doctor of law. So doctor of homeopathy and doctor of law from Savannah. He was the individual who found this charter and basically brought it to the attention of the health freedom movement. And so I posted it on the internet in his memory, and you can find it if you go to my website, which is vitaminlawyer, one word, vitaminlawyer.com, and you'll see there's a list of the articles I've published and whatnot, and one of those articles is a link to the Herbalist Charter. So it's there on the internet. You can actually Google Herbalist Charter Henry VIII, and you'll probably end up with that page anyway. So interesting to read. It's amazing to see how these people behaved. And yet it goes on, and a few centuries later, in the 1800s, the various states of the United States adopted the Medical Practices Acts. Now, these were, there's an institution in the U.S. Of the commissioners of uniform state laws, which basically try to get their various states to make their laws uniform, so we have a uniform commercial code. Well, the same thing was done, basically, with the practice of medicine. And they adopted the Medical Practices Acts. And the Medical Practices Acts basically define what is medicine and what is not medicine, and then outlaw people who are not licensed doing what is medicine. In the 1930s, these same Medical Practices Acts were amended all around the country and made more uniform. And in that round of amendments in the 1930s, they removed from the definition of medicine such terms as homeopathy and eclecticism. Eclecticism is what we call herbalism today, or nutritional practices. And they were removed from the practice of medicine, which meant to me that they're not part of medicine, and anyone can do them. I certainly view the way the current Medical Practices Act is set up as being very much limited to just surgery and drugs. And anything beyond that is something that the average individual who's been trained to do it can do. Or as the charter says, as the Herbalist Charter says, people that I'm going to find, so I can find the exact phrase here. It's really great. It really basically talks about people who have common knowledge. and how that knowledge is just as valuable as the knowledge of you know, of the physicians.
Yes.
But
yes.
And it has status. Well, that's beginning to sink into our system even today. And as a result of some lawsuits against the AMA for restraint of trade back in the 1980s and 90s, there was a change made in the code of ethics that the medical community is supposed to be living by. You know, back in the beginning, the medical code of ethics was really simple: do no harm. Right. Since then, it's turned into a little booklet that's about 125 pages long and a lot of details.
In Chapter 2 of Spontaneous Healing by Andrew Weil, he mentions that an MD license limits them to the practice
that's
of
right.
surgery. And
a personal. License is a limitation, a phrase I've used with many of my physician clients.
Right, and that's why a lot of people are surprised. And you know, I deal with that objection quite a lot when I'm dealing with herbs.
So what
people think
is,
that if it was good for them, their doctor would tell them about it.
The
but they really can't talk about herbs.
Right. In fact, no one is allowed to cure disease with herbs.
Right.
Whether you're a physician or not, because
yes.
you can only claim to cure disease, A, if you're a physician, and B, if you're using standard methods.
Right.
Anything beyond the standard is, you know, is not allowed.
And
so,
anything else would be
where does that leave us? Well,
admission.
It does leave us with some openings that are coming about. Because of that lawsuit, AMA had to adopt something called Opinion 3.04. You know, and although... and these ethics opinions are what basically is the backbone of the entire structure of ethics for medicine. Although in Ethics Opinion 3.02, it says that unscientific practitioners, you know, physicians are not allowed to cooperate with unscientific practitioners, whatever that means. It says in this new section that physicians are, you know, actually encouraged to cooperate with it. And it gives a whole series of words and
talk
concepts.
About that.
And what it basically boils down to is, anyone who's permitted to provide healthcare services, and when it comes to herbalism and nutrition, except in a very few states, there are no licenses. So anyone is permitted to do that. There are a couple of states in which there are licenses for nutritionists. I don't think there are any for herbalists.
Well, I know that in the state of Ohio, we can get in a great deal of trouble here from
right.
the Dietitians Board if we.
Right. Yeah, the dietitians have tried to monopolize the field of nutrition, and yet they're not trained as nutritionists. They're trained in dietetics, which is a, you know, the study of food for institutions and that sort of stuff.
Right.
Nutritionists
right.
deal with individuals and individual nutritional needs.
Right.
And you know,
allergies.
There are very important federal cases about acupuncture that apply directly to that. And if anyone wanted to sue Ohio and have the resources to take it up to the Supreme Court, I'm sure that those laws would be overturned.
Wow.
In the modern context, it would not be allowed. But what is allowed is that physicians are now permitted to cooperate with what's called other healthcare, other therapies that may benefit. You know, there's a little trick of language here. Things that that claim to treat disease must be only within the scope of medicine. Things that may just benefit people are not part of medicine, but are part of other things like nutrition, herbology, massage therapy. Those are things that may benefit individuals, but do not claim to cure disease. The words cure disease or treat disease are terms of art that belong to the medical profession. They you know, they ship a little circled R after them, right? And no one else can use those words.
Yeah,
and that's what it comes down to. It's a word game where
yeah.
where if you can help people, you can work with them and help them achieve and maintain a state of wellness, but if you claim to be curing or treating, you're going to be in trouble.
I ran into a phrase from a doctor one time. He said, "No, we don't claim to cure this particular type of disease." We were talking about a heart
yep.
issue that my husband had. They said, "We call it disease management."
That's right. Oh yeah, they love to have permanent patients on permanent medications, right? You never ever achieve a state of wellness. You're always in a different state of disease.
And
that
why,
is certainly the pathologist's philosophical viewpoint on the world, and that's what led them to create the licensing system they've created.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's true. I mean, it does all fit together.
All heard about Codex coming from an international lawmaking
right.
body.
Well, yeah, the World Health Organization and the Food and Agricultural Organization, the WHO and the FAO, got together 47 years ago, and created a joint project called Codex Alimentarius, which is Latin for the food code, It's the International Food Code, and it's always had a schizophrenic personality. On one hand, it is supposed to promote health and well-being through, you know, better food. On the other hand, it's supposed to promote freer trade of food. And the two don't always seem to go together, it appears. And the institution, as it's developed, has become to a very great extent a creature or a captive of big pharma and big agra. And as a result, they adopt guidelines and standards that tend to ignore or be hostile to alternatives. I see this. I've gone to, I was recently at a Codex labeling meeting up in Toronto, and I went to the organic seminar the day before the meeting started, where they were discussing Codex and organic foods. And you'd be surprised at the non-organic ingredients or substances that Codex would allow companies to use when they're processing so-called organic foods. A lot of the countries that really value organics are just resisting that, but it was very interesting to watch the U.S. and the EU delegations trying to manipulate the system to allow substances in that are clearly not organic, you know, except in the very vague sense that they're made of carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, right? So it was very interesting, and I see that happening not just with dietary supplements. Codex back a year ago adopted a vitamin and mineral guideline, for example, but also in the area of organic foods and in GMOs and in radiation. The U.S. does not really want Codex to mandate that labels be honest, that labels tell people when they're genetically modified ingredients, that labels tell people when they're irradiated ingredients.
We've heard rumors that...
Apparently, the U.S. delegation apparently doesn't believe in that the consumer has a right to know anything.
Right.
So there we see this happening in Codex. Well, the big issue is the guideline, this vitamin and mineral guideline that was adopted that basically tries to treat vitamins and minerals as though they were toxic industrial chemicals. I mean,
yeah.
It may be proper to do that for drugs, because that's what drugs are, toxic industrial chemicals, but it's not proper to do that for food.
The confusion may be that they come in a capsule form.
I don't think there's confusion at all. I think it's very intentional. But there's a major and growing awareness, especially among developing countries, that if they allow this to happen, their traditional nutritional approaches to wellness will be outlawed, basically.
Right.
And they're not going to let that happen. There's a growing alliance of developing countries and health freedom activists that is showing up at, let's put it that way, showing up at meetings, at international meetings, through NGOs and through national delegations. For example, South Africa has taken a strong position in favor of, you know, traditional medicine and treating nutrients as foods, not as chemicals.
Why do they want to treat vitamins as toxins?
Well, the chairman of one of the Codex committees happens to own a company in Germany that does toxic risk analysis. So maybe that's one of the reasons. Maybe they have a bias, you know, and not necessarily even conscious. I mean, if you're in the business of doing toxic risk analysis, maybe you'd automatically assume that should apply. But foods are not toxins.
Let me give you some statistics.
Yeah.
From the Journal of the American Medical Association, there was a study done that spanned a 10-year period from 1983 to 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And it showed 140,000 deaths per year from prescription drug use.
That's correct prescription drug use, right?
Pardon me? Yes,
that's correct prescription drug use.
Yes. And I just read a recent article in, I think it's Life Extensions magazine, that claimed 800,000 deaths per year,
which makes
it the number one cause of death in America. And then the second thing on that chart was foodborne illness, and that was 9,000 deaths from that. That would be your Jack in the Box hamburger and so forth.
Right.
And then 300 from over-the-counter drugs, and there were in that 10-year time period, there were only 3 deaths from all supplements, and that was the tainted drugs.
Well, claimed to be from supplements. I mean, we have that
and
famous
zero from all herbs.
We have that famous baseball player who allegedly died as a result of ephedra, and it turned out, you know, the guy had a heart condition. He hadn't eaten. He was out in 100-degree weather exercising and had taken 3 times the recommended dose, which is why, by the way, our law in the United States is very clear. You don't judge a nutrient by someone abusing it. You judge a nutrient by what happens when you take it, when you use it as directed.
Right, and ephedra,
you know,
if combined with caffeine, makes it a little bit more scary.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, no, you know, Ephedra, and now, by the way, there's a wonderful federal judge in Utah who, April of last year, made the correct decision when she basically overturned part of the ephedra ban, because the evidence that FDA relied on to ban ephedra had to do with high doses of ephedra, and even that evidence was very inconclusive. But there was no evidence at all that, that low doses would cause any problem.
So we may get our ephedra back?
Oh, well, there are two companies in Utah that are selling ephedra now. It's got to be 10 milligrams or under.
Okay.
And the problems are that the FDA says that, that the court decision only applies to those two companies, which is ridiculous. And so a lot of the other companies are afraid to do anything, and the insurance companies don't want to insure. And
well,
sometimes
history.
It's the insurance companies and what they're willing to do, and the credit card processing companies and what they're willing to do that determines what is on the market.
The history of ephedra goes
back
6,000 years.
And I know that from some direct experiences on behalf of clients.
Yeah. The history of ephedra goes back 6,000 years in China,
right.
And there's really nothing better for clearing congestion than that.
Right. And it is a metabolic, a safe metabolic stimulant.
Mm-hmm.
But like anything else, you know, if you really try, you can you know, gosh, you can hurt yourself by drinking too much water.
Yes, you can.
You know? I mean, yeah. It's, you know, and shall we judge water by that, or shall we judge by it? On the other hand, taking prescription drugs as prescribed, that is correctly, results in 140 or 800,000 deaths a year, you know, so I find that, and why? Well, because the law says that prescription drugs, regulated, you know, prescription drugs are allowed to have side effects up to and including death.
But
nutrients are not allowed to. And that's the way the law is currently written in this country and much of the world. And in the United States, the law is written in a much more favorable way to nutrients than in other parts of the world.
Yes, we have the DSHEA Act.
Right, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994, which I helped lobby for back then and certainly support. Not perfect. You know, we've done some work on that. The Natural Solutions Foundation, HealthFreedomUSA.org, helped support myself and another attorney's efforts to rewrite the DSHEA. And we've created a model international a model act for countries to adopt to allow claims to be made for on nutrients. And
now,
that model act can be found at on the website actually of the Natural Solutions Foundation. And it's an interesting. You know, we basically took DSHEA, cleaned it up, and made sure it was consistent with international standards. And we've offered it to the international community.
So
a lot of countries are just beginning to understand that nutritional approaches, herbal approaches, have a great deal of value.
I think for the listener out there, let's define DSHEA a little bit. It makes the nutritional supplement not a drug and not treated as a drug in standards and.
Well, again, you know, it's always a matter of intent and claims. So what
yeah.
it really does is it says if you only use certain types of claims. Then the FDA is not allowed to consider you a drug.
Right.
And so there are, if you will, four levels of claims. And on the most basic level is what I would call a general wellness claim. You know, take your B vitamins to feel good. The second level up are what are called structure and function claims, which define the relationship between the nutrient and the normal structure and function of the body. And those are the claims you see all over the place. You know, maintains normal this and you know normal bone health or whatever it may be. And
but
those
we have
are claims
to be careful
that,
not to cure anything.
Yeah, and the third level up are what are called health claims, which are characterized by the relationship between a nutrient and some disease or health condition. Now, a good example of that might be one that I like to tell people about: N-acetylcysteine, NAC.
Okay.
Reduces the amount of bacteria in the lungs, even of chronic smokers, by a third.
Okay, or
now that's a health claim.
Or
so people who sell NAC are not allowed to make that right now. Health claims can be made only after FDA approval. Structure function claims you can make without FDA approval. Health claims you have to go first to FDA, and FDA used to refuse to basically allow health claims. I mean, they allowed one or two, the folic acid claim for neural tube defects, for example. And then life extension theorists, Dirk Pearson and Sandy Shaw, sued the FDA, and in, I think it was 2000, they won their lawsuit. It's a case called Pearson versus Shalala, and the FDA now has to allow what are called conditional health claims where there's not enough evidence for the FDA to be satisfied, but because of the court order, they allow the health claim with a condition. You know, you say X claim, and then you give the limiting factors. And so that they've allowed maybe 8 or 9 or 10 of those so far. I mean, gosh, there could be hundreds or thousands that people could make. So we're just on the beginning of that process, and it would be good to change DSHEA so that it's easier to get those petitions approved. You know, of course, I would prefer to allow people to speak freely about nutrients and tell what they know and be responsible for what they say rather than have regulations at all. I think it's a First Amendment issue. Like Justice, I think it's Justice Thomas, I think that there's no such thing as commercial speech, and the government should not be interfering with speech. You know, so but that's a minority opinion in the legal profession at the present time, unfortunately. But it goes to, by the way, an important case, maybe the most important case in the past 10 years on health freedom issues, and that's the case of Thompson versus Western States Medical, in which was a 5-4 decision about the nature of commercial speech, and of course it was Judge Thomas who was the swing vote on that one, and in his little one paragraph concurring opinion, he refers to commercial speech in quotes 3 times, just to show that he doesn't believe that there's any distinction, that Americans have the right to speak freely, and the government has no business, you know, regulating that speech. But under that new case, basically it becomes very difficult for the government to regulate truthful speech about health matters. And I think we're going to see a lot more openness developing in the next few years as all that sort of is assimilated by the system.
Well, we're certainly seeing a grassroots movement toward that, and I've been helping to stimulate it here in Ohio.
That's good. Well, the thing to do would be to seek, you know, a health freedom law. There are a number of groups around the country who are supporting various state level laws that would protect MDs who are offering alternative services, and also laws that that allow individuals access to complementary alternative methodologies. Without government interference.
I know here in Ohio we're working to put a similar law to the.
That's
one
right.
That
I'm on one of those email lists. I get those emails, and I'm watching it develop. I see a very strong possibility that Ohio will move from the category of one of the most restrictive states to the category of one of the least restrictive. Fairly.
Well, as one of my chiropractor friends told me, we have 6 medical schools in Ohio. So what do we expect?
Right, you know, but you know, the medical profession is beginning to learn, and young doctors really want to take a much more holistic approach.
Right.
They really see that the old slash and burn approach is not really doing that good. I mean, they see the statistics. It is the, you know, their own journals that publish the statistics about the number of people who die from prescription drugs, the number of people who die in hospitals of preventable causes. I mean, they see that the healthcare system is becoming, you know.
When you say cut, slash, and burn, I want to elaborate on that a little.
Yeah.
That's based on the notion that what you have in you has to be killed off or cut out in order for you to get well.
Right.
And of course, the whole naturopathic approach is a more supportive of the systems that need to cooperate with one another, and we do that by feeding the systems what specific nutrients that they need.
Right, it's nourishing
process.
Normal structure and function.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's perfectly intelligent as an approach. It's well recognized in most other parts of the world. But
exactly. Oh, there's a wonderful.
Not here.
To recommend some reading for people in the area. There's a Amit Goswami, who's actually a PhD in physics and a very famous quantum physicist, and one of the talking heads in What to Believe and a few other things. Recently wrote a book called The Quantum Doctor, which is brilliant, and I highly recommend it to people. Hampton Roads with the publisher in, I think, 2004. I've been in the middle of reading it now, and it's really opened my mind many ways to just how scientifically real these alternatives are. And he just shows the basis of it, and he shows that the opposition to mind-body and nutritional approaches is an opposition that's based on old physics, on old scientific paradigms that have been abandoned by physicists for half a century and more.
Uh-huh.
Yet the medical profession is
still
stuck in those old paradigms.
Wow. I want to remind folks that you can call in if you have questions. The phone number, I think, is 877-876-5227. please give us a call if you have a question for either one of us. We'd love to hear from you. Okay.
I'd like to talk a little bit, as I've been talking, about this distinction that I see. I was talking about the AMA Code of Ethics, and there is, in my mind, this distinction that all the alternative practitioners need to understand between the treatment of disease on one hand and therapies that may benefit on the other. And I've written about that as well, and it got posted on, let's see, I'm trying to think of where that's posted. There are the second alternative practices. Ah, there it is. If anyone wants to take a look at my alternative therapeutic practices essay, it's entitled "The Alternative Therapeutic Practices and the AMA Code of Ethics," and you can get at it through my Vitamin Lawyer website, vitaminlawyer.com. But it's also actually posted at another website, and that other website is Life Spirit, one word, lifespirit.org/alternative-practices-htm. And I think you have to have a capital A and a capital P, so it's alternative-practices-htm, and it's at the on the Life Spirit website, www.lifespirit.org. I think what I tried to do in that essay was sketch out from a number of different standpoints what the distinction is between therapy or therapeutic approaches and treatment. And I think I define it in the beginning here, and I think it's well worth just reading the paragraphs. It's carefully done. This essay considers the use of the terms therapy and therapeutic with reference to alternative health practices. It compares those terms to the term of art, treatment of diseases. Alternative or complementary health practices can generally be defined as traditional or other practices that are used by individuals, often for self-help, to achieve and maintain a healthy status, either on their own, or complementary to standard medical care. These practices do not include the potentially dangerous use of invasive techniques and toxic drugs that are the province of licensed medicine. They do, however, include developing therapies and non-standard approaches that are outside the scope of licensed medicine. Such approaches, such as nutrition, homeopathy, hands-on healing, herbology, are examples of alternative therapeutic practices. Traditional Chinese or Ayurvedic medicine or folk remedies, you know, and Dr. Mom home remedies, are also examples of alternative practices. These practices aim, in the words of Philip Hodes, PhD, at, quote, more efficient physiological integration and function of the human organism, leading to optimal wellness. And that's, I think, you know, a good approach to the difference between the two. Doctors treat disease, they manage diseases, you know. People who are offering these alternative therapies are doing something else. They're doing something that's going to benefit the whole person, leading to a state of wellness. And that's the distinction, I think. And you hit it right on the head when you talked about the MD who says all they do is manage disease.
Mm-hmm. He literally...
What you do, of course, is for wellness. So that's the distinction there.
Could you perhaps give us some guidance on how we could individually, in whatever state or country we're living in, do something toward bringing this health freedom to the surface?
Yeah, there are a lot of really good organizations out there that are struggling for health freedom. I would strongly recommend healthfreedomusa.org, which I guess will soon have links to similar organizations in other countries. There's a branch of the foundation being set up in India, for example. That's one good organization. The National Health Federation, which is, I think, the NHF.org, I believe that's it, but you can just Google National Health Federation. They're the oldest and most prestigious, and they actually have observer status at Codex and things like that. Very good group of people.
And if you happen to live in Ohio, please write to your senator and your representatives and help us get these things out of committee and onto the floor.
Absolutely.
You can probably Google
Ohio Health Freedom and find the organizations that are working on that, because there's some very good active people in that area right now.
I'd like to tell the story about the Minnesota trial that actually stimulated all that. There was a farmer who was selling colostrum.
Right.
And he got himself into deep trouble for that. And the jury they acted on the law that was present in Minnesota at the time and found him guilty. Then they got involved in changing the law. Sherry was telling me that there's something you can do called nullification of the jury.
That's right. That's what you're telling the story.
People should know about how to do that.
It is sad that Americans don't know, don't remember their rights, you know, and don't remember about jury nullification. I mean, you know, just back in the 1930s, people remembered and they refused to enforce prohibition, and prohibition was repealed, alcohol prohibition, because the juries would no longer convict. And, you know, and Americans used to remember that they had the ultimate power to change the government by refusing to convict their fellow citizens on unjust laws. And they understood that the jury had the right to determine the justice of the law as well as whether the person is guilty or not. And that goes back a long time. That goes back to the Magna Carta jury nullification. And in fact, here in New Jersey, the last state Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice, wrote a long article condemning jury nullification. How terrible it was that people should, someone who's not a professional judge should actually, you know, have a role to play. But clearly, in our constitutional system, the jury was to have the final veto. And unless jurors know that they can refuse, that a juror can say, despite the law, yes, the law is really clear, this person really did all that, and I'm going to refuse to vote guilty despite that law because it's unjust. And I have a conscience, and my conscience will not allow me to be responsible for injustice. Until people are willing to do that, there will be unjust laws. And when people stand up and say, I have a personal conscience, I have to make a personal just decision, then unjust laws will not be enforceable because it will be impossible to find 12 people to commit that sort of injustice against their neighbors.
I believe
strongly in jury nullification. Yeah. One of my great heroes, the famous libertarian lawyer from the 1800s, Lysander Spooner, wrote a wonderful book on that called The Essay on Trial by Jury, in which he shows all the legal precedents concepts, and it's clear. But, you know, on the federal court level, there was the famous Barragan cases in the 1960s where the Barragan priests, the two priests' brothers were convicted of spilling blood on the draft records in Camden, New Jersey. And they tried to defend themselves. They wanted to tell the jury, you know, you have a right to judge the justice of the law. And the decision of the appeals court was, although jury nullification is the law, and no one can prevent a jury from refusing to convict despite the law, nonetheless, the judge can refuse to tell the jury that that's the law, and the judge can order the defense lawyers to say nothing about it.
So
that is the law. The judges cannot say that you may not nullify this law. They can't actually talk against jury nullification, but they can kill it by silence. And when you walk into a federal, you know, into a federal courthouse and you see the posters there for the jurors, where the first rule of the jurors is they have to accept the law as given by the judge. Well, no, not if they think it's an unjust law. They have to act on their conscience as free citizens and not as good, you know, as good Germans. You know, they can't just find someone guilty because that's what the law says. They have to first decide if it's right or wrong.
So it's, again, taking
it's
power
abrogation
back
in your own hands. And Americans are abrogating their birthright as free individuals when they just go along with the fascist society that we seem to be developing.
I understand that the founding fathers actually considered putting in a freedom of medical choice.
Well, they should have, certainly, you know, but as we know, putting things in or taking them out of the Constitution doesn't help much. I mean, gosh, they put in a clause about, you know, only gold and silver being money, and, you know, what do we have? And no clause saying they create a central bank. See, they created a central bank, and it has watched over the destruction of 98% of the value of the dollar in the past 90 years.
Wow. But because we didn't put it in at a federal level, we do need to go in state by state.
That's
it. Health Freedom Act.
Can you describe
what that is, that Health Freedom Act that we're striving for?
Every state needs to do that.
Yes. And what does it consist of?
Well, different states have different people taking different approaches. Basically, some of them are saying that individuals have a right to access all forms of healthcare therapy, and that regulatory restrictions are not allowed. Most of the laws include clauses protecting MDs specifically if they want to use alternatives. It's in general, and it varies from state to state. I think New York State has a fairly simple one that has been adopted, but even that law in New York, gosh, The five leading female alternative MDs in New York all lost their licenses in the past 5 years.
Oh, my.
And they all lost them for reasons other than alternative practices. There's always a regulation that you're violating.
Oh, my.
Whether you're a doctor or a lawyer or a dentist or anyone.
Well, that brings to mind
the regulations are so complex that you're always violating the regulation, so you can always be gotten rid of.
It brings to mind a female MD here in Ohio who has limited right to practice in the hospital or something because of her use of herbs and even colostrum.
Well, in New York, what happened is if they charge you with doing something wrong in the complementary field under this new law, they have to have complementary MDs on the committee.
Oh.
And so they never charge anything having to do with complementary. They
so
only
they find
charge
something
technical
else wrong
violations and of record keeping.
I see.
And therefore they don't have to have alternate MDs on the and so the law is meaningless, so the law doesn't protect
them. Even the alternative MDs are in trouble by the present laws that we have. Just a practicing herbalist or
that's right. Yeah. It's actually better. I know a number of MDs who have basically willingly given up their license because they know that it's limiting them in helping the people they want to help. And they're going on and they're basically doing nutrition and doing herbology and working in non-toxic ways.
Yes. My father used to offer me the money to go to and get a license. And I said, I don't want to do that. I really want to practice herbs.
Right.
I don't
That's
think
good.
I'd get to do that if
you,
I was.
He didn't know that you were reaching into the future instead of the past. But that's very good.
Mm.
Well, now, herbs, interestingly enough, are not within the Codex Vitamin and Mineral Guideline, this terrible document that would restrict international trade in useful vitamins. Herbs have been reserved to the WHO directly, but we fear that the nutrients inside the herbs would be covered by the Vitamin and Mineral Guideline, and so the Codex can sort of backdoor its way in.
Which
and
means
that
what to
us?
Us?
Now, we also rewrote the Vitamin and Mineral Guideline itself, this document that was produced a year ago that wants to try to treat nutrients as though they were toxins, and we've offered that to the international community as well. And so there's an interesting e-book that you can get if you go to the Natural Solutions Foundation website, healthfreedomusa.org, and it sort of outlines all those issues. There's a lot of information on Codex around.
Say that again so that people can write it down.
Sure. If you go to it's healthfreedomusa.org, and it's the Natural Solutions Foundation, and you'll have a lot of interesting information on Codex there. My good friend Dr. Rima Labow, who is the medical director of the foundation, just came back to the East Coast from about an eight-week trip that included Africa, then the Codex meeting in Europe, and then India, and back again, and she's covered all that on her blog, and it's a very interesting blog. So anyone who's interested in what it's like to be an MD who's practicing alternatives and also trying to have an impact internationally, it's an interesting blog.
I want to acknowledge you, Ralph, for all the work you've done on that on a worldwide level, because I know that a lot of that has been at your own expense.
Yes.
Why are you doing that?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, good lawyers are supposed to do things pro bono to some degree. Greedy lawyers don't, but you try to do things to help the community if you can within your means. I've always been very interested in alternatives. My wife is a student of Sherry Edwards and a researcher in human bioacoustics. I've taken courses in homeopathy and I've really been interested in alternatives for many years. I consider myself basically a part-time lawyer and part-time consultant in the field.
And you're going to keep us all from throwing ourselves in jail. Thank you.
Yeah,
that's
part of it too. But I'm leaving it more and more to young lawyers to actually go out and fight with judges. I see my role more as an educational role as time goes on. I really want to make sure that people understand these concepts because nobody reads anymore, so we have to keep on repeating things to them. I want people to understand that there are consequences. There are moral consequences. I mean, when Americans are on juries, there was this nice couple, Polish immigrant couple up here in Sussex County, New Jersey, who were helping people with homeopathy, and they ended up getting hauled before the court. And one member of the jury happened to be a libertarian from here in Sussex County who understood jury nullification, and they were not convicted, because he refused. He said he had to make a moral choice, that he couldn't just be an automaton. He wasn't there to be a rubber stamp to the authorities. He was there to make a choice based on his own sense of right and wrong.
Wow.
And Americans need to reassert, you know, that sense of right and wrong, that that willingness to not go along with the herd. Americans used to be individualists. Instead, we are all walking in lockstep now, you know, into the glorious future, mediated by federally provided psychoactive substances, no doubt.
Well, we left Europe because we were looking for various freedoms, and
yes.
This would have been probably one of them.
You got it. Exactly. And I applaud people like you who are actually out there helping individuals using the traditional and new knowledge that we're gaining.
Well, I've asked you onto the show partly as a selfish interest. I want to make sure that anything that I do say on the show in the future is not
it's a matter of learning
me
a
or
language.
Anyone else
it's really, you know, it's a matter of learning a language, and I'll tell you all a story about that.
Okay.
I was having this discussion a decade ago with the chief attorney for the New Jersey Medical Board. My client is a nutritionist who specialized in working with people who were in terminal cancer situations, not to cure their cancer, but to really help them feel better, and sometimes, you know, there would be spontaneous remissions, you know. But he was hauled before the authorities, raided and hauled before the authorities, and the attorney and I had a discussion about the difference between nutrition and medicine. And when he got done, I said to him, well, let me see if I understand this. Now, someone comes to my client and says to him, my doctor says I've got cancer and it's metastasizing. And my client says to him, to the person, I'm sorry to hear that. I want you to take 20 grams of vitamin C a day to stop those metastasizing cells from adhering elsewhere in your body. But that's practicing medicine. And he said, of course it is. And then I said to the attorney for the medical board, but if the same person comes to my client and says the same thing to him, and my client says, I'm sorry to hear that. Let's talk about your general well-being. I want you to take 20 grams of vitamin C a day for your general health, but that's not practicing medicine. And the lawyer said to me, precisely. And the attorney was very astute. He understands how the system operates. And he, you know, said chief representative for the medical board. So that's, you know, what we're doing here. We're playing a word game while people are dying.
What I've talked,
which
what
I find, you know, morally reprehensible.
I do too. What I have found myself limited in, and when I teach about herbs, is that I have to stick with stories about what has worked for me, what's worked mm-hmm. for other people I know, and I refer to books about what might happen if you use these nutrients.
Well, everybody's an individual, so people have individual responses.
Right, and then I have people criticizing because I haven't come up with a double-blind study with 5,000 people over a five-year period. But those are very expensive studies to conduct.
And, you know, we're dealing with traditional use, and even the FTC and the FDA allow claims based on traditional use, but, you know, that the traditional use is not a substantiation. It's just an explanation.
And yet we're stuck
and
with
you
that
are allowed to
because
talk
we're
about
illegal
traditional
to go anywhere else.
I'm sorry?
We're stuck with that because we'd be illegal if we start going somewhere else with our claims, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
We could always go to Commission E out of Germany, too. There's quite a lot of research that's been done on various nutrients and
good.
Reported in that document. It's huge, but it's well worth having, at least knowing where there is one nearby you.
Ah.
So have you run into that one?
No, I haven't.
Oh,
Commission E in Germany. I will learn about that.
It's a great resource document.
There's an IBID. The U.S. government maintains something called the IBID. Database, which is over 500,000 peer-reviewed and published studies on herbs and nutrients.
Oh.
And what does IBID stand for? Let me pop that out of here. I'm going to see by my computer. Can't talk these days without having a computer in front of me.
While you're looking for that,
yeah.
When I do my historical program on the Herb Lady, I have found somewhere that in the year 1830, there was a pharmacopoeia that the U.S. government put out, and there are still 120 of those same herbs used for the same thing now as it was then. So even way
also.
Back in the early
right.
1800s, you know, the research had already been done. People
here it is, IBIDS, IBIDS, the International Bibliographic Information on Dietary Supplements Database.
Ah.
And it's part of the Office of Dietary Supplements in the National Institutes of Health. It has a very long URL,
NIH,
so I think
huh?
the best thing to find it is to Google it. You know, let's see, home. Maybe there's a way to get to it. What is the home here?
Okay. Say it one more time. It's IBIDS database. Okay, I'll
be looking for that. IBIDS. That means International Bibliographic Information on dietary supplements.
Okay.
And it's part of the Office of Dietary Supplements in the Institute, in the National Institutes of Health.
Okay. All right, we'll be sure and look for that.
Yeah, it's really good documentation.
Okay.
So you see, there are a lot of resources there. When people say that it's unscientific, they just don't understand. To a great extent, the regulators and the people in the medical community who are not doing this on a day-to-day basis but are in administrative positions really don't understand what's happening out there in the world.
Right.
And happening is there's a really good, strong scientific basis to both herbology, to homeopathy, to energy medicine, to all sorts of other alternatives that are coming into the fore, because we are now dealing with the diseases, chronic diseases of undernutrition and malnutrition. That's what we're actually dealing with in the world.
Watch the movie Supersize Me, and you'll see why in America we're dealing with that.
Yeah.
We're number 37 in the world in our health level of health.
Right.
Among 108 countries, we're number 37. Isn't that exciting?
Well,
it finally took a look at our health. Really,
it's about time. Yet we spend so much more than almost any other country. I do note, however, that Americans are digging into their own pockets to pay for alternative and complementary modalities.
Right.
They're doing that.
And
it's not covered by insurance, and they're doing it to such a great extent that they're. I think in the past couple of years, people have actually spent more out of their own pockets on those things than they've spent through the insurance companies on anything other than, drugs and surgery and the other stuff.
Yes. Ralph, I see that our time's nearly up. Can we count on you to come back some other time?
I would love to.
That'd
I enjoy BBS Radio. It's a great, great institution. And anytime you'd like me on, I'd be happy to talk.
Okay.
Always enjoy talking to you.
I'm not sure how much time I have left. If there's any phone calls that need to come in, I guess we'll talk until until time runs out here. But we're always looking for ways to get more healthy, to take matters into our own hands, and to be self-generating, be powerful human beings.
That's right.
And so until next time, I guess I'm gonna sign off here. Anything else you want to say, Ralph? Tell us where your email and website
are. Well, the best way to contact me is to go to my website, vitaminlawyer.com. My email is on there in a number of places, I'd be happy to contact anybody who wants to communicate. Everyone offers interesting views and interesting information to me, so happy to talk to you all.
And my email is NGINGERICH at cinci.rr.com. If you'll send me your questions, we'll start answering them on the show. That would be kind of fun. My website is under construction, and it is lavenderglenn.com. So I guess we'll sign off now, and thank you all very much for listening.
Have a great day.
All right.
Bye now.
Bye.